Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, April 6th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, providing up-to-date information on new visitation policies and coronavirus information at Saratoga Hospital, saratogahospital.org, and social media for details. Joining us on the line today is virologist Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He is ready to take your questions about the coronavirus. He has been on this program several times since the pandemic started hitting closer to home. We anticipate a lot of calls today. Give us a call early if you want to get in. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Eric Yeager, your call's coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on the line today is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager's research focuses on alterations in the immune system that make the elderly more susceptible to disease. He explores the impact of aging on immunity, which is relevant right about now. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Yeager, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, or you can call 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager, welcome back, sir.
Glad to be back, Ray. I hope you and your family are well and healthy.
And same to you. Everything going well?
Everything's well, thank you.
Good. You know,
appreciate it.
It's been about 10 days since you've been on. What have you been doing with your free time?
Teaching my students from home, which has been an interesting adjustment for me and for them. Go ahead, sorry.
Is it easy for you to motivate college-age kids? I know it's a little difficult with some of the younger ones, I can see from firsthand experience.
Yeah, it's a challenge to move from, especially when it was unplanned, to move from an in-person classroom setting where I can talk to my students individually to a remote setting. And some students are good at interacting via that format. Some prefer it, and some it's a little hard to tell. And I think the biggest issue is they're dealing with a lot of off-campus things, with new responsibilities, with, unfortunately, family members becoming ill. So I try to, in addition to teaching the students, myself and my faculty colleagues are trying to make sure and do wellness checks on our students, make sure they're doing okay, because it's been a big shift for them these past few weeks.
Well, it has been, as I said, a week or 10 days since you were on the program last time. What have we learned about this coronavirus since then?
Sure. We've learned that there's a lot of gaps in our knowledge that get filled in. When it first started, I called it, or other people have called it, a rapidly evolving situation. There's a lot we didn't know then, we know now, and there's still a lot of gaps in our knowledge, and there's a lot of things that knowledge comes up, but then it's contradictory to what we had before. So it's, I know it can be frustrating, and there's a lot of news and information out there, and what we say one week, and then the next week it changes, like, for example, with the wearing of masks, which we can get into if you like. But
yeah.
I just learned that there's a lot that we're learning in that process, and more importantly, there's just so much research going on. There's scientists really working 24/7. To really find cures, treatments and vaccines against this virus.
There are three things I want to touch on before we get to the calls. And once again, the number is 800-348-2551. And you hit on the first one. It's masks. We've heard, don't wear them. Wear them. Wear them if you think you have it. Wear them if you're walking down the street. My instinct tells me if I'm wearing it and I don't have it, it probably is not worth the effort. But maybe I'm wrong.
I think you hit on the nail on the head with the one thing that's changed the most since the last time I was on the show is, even I'm seeing in grocery stores, people wearing masks. And you're right, we told individuals, or the government and CDC is telling people, you know, don't wear a mask, save those for the healthcare professionals and providers. And I think what changed information-wise is that as more people became sick and we were able to track the courses of disease in communities, it became clear that there were a number of people spreading it that were asymptomatic.
Yeah.
So what that means is people that weren't showing the, you know, when I first came on, you know, we talked about the symptoms being the fever, the cough, the trouble breathing. But there's a proportion of people that don't experience that, and people that are younger as well. And the concern was there were individuals that were not showing symptoms spreading the disease. So the idea of wearing masks, again, is not to protect you as wearing it. It's really to, if you are sick, it's to prevent you from passing it to other people. So it's really a change in mentality. Again, it's not, and I think that's where a lot of the trepidation first came in with the CDC deciding what to do, because there's some concerns with, do people now feel like they're a bit more invincible, that social distancing might fall to the wayside. And again, this is not to replace that. There's also concerns that masks are not the same masks that are used in health settings, like the surgical masks or the N95s that we talked about previously. So these are really meant to protect other people. So if you are one of those people that are asymptomatic and you're out, you know, and again, you don't want to go out as often as you used to, but if you do still have to go to the grocery store and the pharmacy, it's to wear that to prevent any chance that you might spread that to someone else.
Now, you know, you mentioned a great point that a lot of these masks, the good ones, should be in the hands and hopefully are in the hands of medical professionals. We have heard things like, okay, wear a bandana. We see all sorts of social media where people are making their own. Does a piece of cloth provide that much help?
Yeah, from my understanding, it's really the way the masks are designed is to capture particulates, and cloth cannot do that with the same efficiency and ability as a mask can. So they're designed specifically to capture those aerosols. That still seems to be one of the major ways the virus is spread, that if someone were to sneeze or cough, the virus is trapped in those droplets. And as we talked about with the binding of the virus to your cells, that lock and key getting into your cells causing disease, that barrier, that true mask, is going to prevent that, the N95. But the other masks really is to prevent the other way from you coughing and spreading it to someone else.
You know, humor, of course, has to come in the right measure at this time.
But of course.
I was standing on the street, and I saw a guy walking down the street with a wool ski mask on with holes for the eyes and mouth. What possible good is that going to do?
He wasn't coming from a bank, was he?
I don't think so.
Okay. I think it's the other thing with masks too is there's some social aspect of it. It seems like, you know, we're indoors, we're doing our social distancing, but the mask is a very visible sign that we're doing something. So I think there's some mentality associated with it that is you feel a little safer or you feel like you're doing something. But as I mentioned, you don't want to get too cavalier because it's not a shield against the virus. It's
right.
Really only intended to prevent you from passing it to someone else.
Well, our number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined by Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has been nice enough to join us several times in the past few weeks. And just a couple of more quick points, then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. One, I heard a news piece that there was some efficacy to drugs that attacked SARS. You and I have talked a couple of times about this outer coating on the virus. And from what I understood, and maybe you've heard something of this, there are certain, whatever, antivirals that attack SARS that are also attacking this.
Certainly. So what scientists have done a lot of research, as I mentioned in my previous appearances, that this virus is a disease we haven't dealt with before, but the idea of a coronavirus has been around for decades. So scientists have been studying other viruses like SARS and MERS, and even the common cold is a version of a coronavirus, not to be confused with what we're dealing with now, but scientists have studied these viruses, and in doing that, they've identified how the virus gets inside a cell, how it replicates, and how it gets out. So having that critical knowledge allows scientists to develop or study drugs and vaccines. So a lot of the same ones we've been talking about 10 or so days ago are still the ones that are paramount, I think, today. So you hear a lot about chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and those are the ones that are really being tested still because of that anecdotal evidence. I think that's the one thing about this pandemic I've learned a lot about is how quickly information travels, both good and bad information.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that come out, and it's, you know, people have hopes. There's a sense of urgency, and we all feel like we want this to break. We want that breakthrough where we can say we're going to be able to tamp this down. And so some of the data comes out and it looks encouraging. But as Dr. Fauci has said, you know, science is a gradual process, but it's important to make sure that we do the studies right, that it's actually going to help more people than it harms. So those two drugs are being heavily studied, and there has been some encouraging, some positive results, but it's still uncertain. Does it help all people? Does it help people with mild or severe disease? Is it good for some age groups and not others? So there's still a lot of unknowns. So I think that I tell people we're certain about uncertainty at this point.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. All right, last point, and then we'll take a break. And I know you're not an epidemiologist, but I had to bring this up. This crossed the AP wire today. It's been on the news all over the place. A tiger at the Bronx Zoo has tested positive for the new coronavirus. It's believed to be the first known infection in an animal in the U.S. or a tiger anywhere, and it looks as if this was transmitted from human to animal. Can that tell you anything?
It's something to look at and maybe study a bit more. I think there's been some other studies of, I think maybe a house cat or dog maybe got the virus from its owner. So there's these very few instances where it looks like the virus has maybe perhaps jumped from person to an animal. If that happens, it's something that scientists want to study to see if now the cycle of the disease is different. If this disease is a zoonotic disease, so normally what we think happens with diseases like coronavirus is it starts in bats, and then it jumps from bats to some other animal, and then unfortunately it jumped to us. And most times that's kind of where the dead end host, that we kind of infect each other, but it could go the other way. So that's something to keep an eye on, but I don't think it's something that, unless you have a pet tiger, to worry about right now.
You know, this is interesting, and then we're overdue for a break. But you mentioned how news changes and facts are sort of malleable early on. And
Right. We
know, or at least we think we know, that bats were the beginning of this. And then it jumped to humans. In this article on the tiger that came down with coronavirus, here's a quote from Dr. Jane Rooney, a veterinarian and USDA official. There doesn't appear to be at this time any evidence that suggests that animals can spread the virus to people or they can be a source of the infection. But isn't that where it started?
It has. I think it's thought that either it jumped from bats to people or there was an intermediary. And in most other zoonotic diseases, there's typically an intermediary. And that was certainly the case with the first SARS in 2003. So that scientists, what they do is they can look at the structure of the virus in bats and in people. And like for this tiger, too, they can see how similar is it. So was there some change? And as we talked about before, in terms of mutation, this is a bit different virus than the flu. So some people still like to call it the flu, and it's not the same virus. It's not the flu for a variety of reasons, both in biology and disease. But this one, it seems that initially it did need an intermediary. Now, whether it stays that way, it's difficult to say.
And then my paranoia is such that, okay, the mosquitoes will be out soon. Knowing what West Nile virus was, should we be concerned about an influx in the summertime?
Right. So in terms of mosquitoes, for the virus to pass from one animal to a person, it needs to have the receptor, so that lock to get into the lock and key to get into that right door to get into a cell. So mosquitoes don't have the same doors that we do. So this virus is not going to be suddenly picked up by a mosquito bite and then transferred to another person like West Nile.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly there are other, diseases, our news is predominantly focused on COVID-19.
Right.
But of course, flu is still in the environment. We have to worry about some other seasonal diseases as well. So it's a bit concerning, but it's something that we, it's not going to, like I mentioned, this is not going to become a mosquito-borne infection by any means.
And I have enough to be terrified of. as it is. All right, Dr. Eric Yeager, we'll take a quick break and then we'll hit the phones.
All right.
800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop Medical Monday, Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest, and we begin in Eagle Mills. Judy, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question, I hope. On many of your cooking shows, you're talking with guests, and they're discussing cooking. Many of the recipes, they only discuss using a range or oven for their cooking. Many people, for multiple number of reasons, use the microwave for some or much of their cooking. You discussed on Vox Pop about killing germs, cooking fresh vegetables in particular, but could you please address, coming from someone who's a nurse, could you please address cooking to using microwave cookery to kill germs?
All right, Eric.
And this one in particular.
Great. Well, thank you, Judy. First, you know, thanks for you being a nurse and all the nurses out there working right now hard every day to help us beat this outbreak. In terms of food, so that's something that even my family members have asked, because restaurants are closed, there's a lot more takeout, a lot more preparation at home. And in a hospital setting, people can use high heat in different ways to disinfect surgical tools. And so there is evidence that, yes, heat and other things can kill germs on surgical tools and things like that, but to achieve that level of heat and pressure is not possible at home. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that there's no evidence as of yet that this virus can be spread through the oral route, so it's still a respiratory virus. That said, there are still precautions when you bring in food, typically from takeout, that you want to make sure that the containers are, well, first off, make sure if you can that it's a contactless delivery, and a lot of services fortunately have adapted that, where you kind of pay, hopefully by credit card, not with cash. If you can, they drop it off. And then when you get the food in, be it food from a restaurant, or if they're still doing produce deliveries, it's still as you would normally kind of wash the produce, but with the containers, you don't necessarily have to wash the containers. You take the food out, use your own utensils, and make sure your hands are washed before and after you handle the food. So I think there's some precautions you can take in terms of handling, but in terms of how you prepare the food, it's not going to have much bearing on the virus or the germs. I hope that helped answer your question.
I'm sure it was very helpful for a lot of us. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. That's kind of a tepid compliment there, Doctor. We'll go to Maria in North Adams. Maria, you're on.
Is it safer to wash hands with soap and water rather than with hand sanitizer? I heard that it was, and I wondered.
So that's a great point. We hear a lot about, the shortage of hand sanitizer, first off, and a lot of distilleries switching to making hand sanitizer. And hand sanitizer is meant to be seen as a substitute. When you can't get access to water and soap, to use hand sanitizer. And unfortunately, we've kind of gotten in the habit, me, myself, when I'm in the lab, you kind of get used to, I'll just squirt some hand sanitizer. But really, the best approach is proper hand washing with warm water and soap. And there's a number of videos online on proper hand washing. You can watch some of those. And it's kind of shocking to realize how long you've been doing it for years. But you pick a song to sing and wash your hands. And that's a far better approach to make sure that the virus is removed from your hands than hand sanitizer. Hand sanitizer will work, but washing hands is better.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Just don't make it like MacArthur Park or some really long song, right?
Yeah, no long ones.
Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on with Dr. Eric Yeager.
How come we don't hear much about the differential diagnosis, which might include Coxsackie, respiratory syncytial adenovirus 14, or pneumococcus, among others?
So there's certainly the chance that individuals coming into the hospital could have co-infections. And I know because the symptoms appear to overlap with influenza, I imagine that they still are testing for both to confirm, is it flu or is it COVID-19? With other viruses, that's something that's probably going to come out as we get more patient data to see if there's any link between certain underlying health conditions and how the person might respond to treatments or how might they do with the disease. But I think right now, because hospitals are swamped with patients coming in, they're looking primarily if they can test for, if the kits are available, to test for COVID-19 and then to start treatment right away. So I think, unfortunately, that's the way the timing and how much cases numbers there are on a daily basis. There's not looking at that just yet.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Our number here on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551. He has been a very popular guest over these many appearances in the past few weeks. Dr. Eric Yeager is back with us today. We'll try to get to as many calls as we can. Robin in Cooperstown. Robin, you're up.
Thank you. My son-in-law is NYPD. Last Thursday, he found out that he had been working with a cop who tested positive. On Friday, he was tested himself, so it was over 24 hours before he could get tested. He was told that results would take 2 to 3 days, or maybe 7, and that they're getting false negatives. Today, around noon, he found out that he was negative, so that's good. Because of the reports of false negatives, should he ask for a second test? And also, what should he be doing at this point to protect his wife, who's immunocompromised?
Great question.
There are three kids in the home. There's no basement to move into. They don't have an RV.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, great question. I think Robin hits a lot of the concerns that we're all feeling. If we get that potential, I interacted with someone that might be positive, and what's my test result going to be? I don't know how accessible tests are in all parts of the state and in the city. They may be able to do a second test. I know for discharging patients, they need to have 2 negative test results within 24 hours. For your son's case, they'll probably, what I would say is look for symptoms. And if his wife is someone that is a higher risk, if he's able to do so, I would probably limit contact even more so than yours doing social distancing outside. So maybe trying to stay in a different room, not to use the same utensils, drinking glasses, make sure that things are cleaned a little bit more than normal, and just kind of wait and see what happens for the next, series of week or so. I think that's the problem, is just the availability of tests and be able to distinguish if someone is truly positive or negative. And also, I don't know if we talked about these in the past, Ray, but serological tests. So if someone has been exposed and has cleared the virus and now they're potentially immune to it. And that's the next area that we're looking for.
Robin, is that good for you?
It helps a bit.
Robin, hey, yeah. Even though we're upstate, next time you talk to your son, thank him for what he is doing down there. We appreciate it.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. And we go over to Kingston, New York. And Bruce, you're on.
Yeah, thank you, Ray and Dr. Yeager, for doing this again. When I went shopping this morning, I wore a scarf over my nose and mouth. Can I use that scarf again, or do I need to throw it away?
So the recommendations are for people that are using cloth masks. I believe on the CDC website, there are instructions for how to launder the masks. You want to use warm water and detergent, bleach if possible. So you can reuse them. The trouble with the frequent washings is probably that the scarf will eventually begin to break up. But you definitely do want to wash in between uses if possible. And then remember, too, that the scarf is really to protect if you were carrying something to protect the other people. So please maintain that 6 feet of distance if you can in a grocery store. And I've been in a store past couple weeks, and it's nice to see that people generally follow those rules. It is a little different shopping now. It feels a bit more somber.
Yes. It's like you ever see that Charlton Heston movie, The Omega Man? It's like, yeah. they're just, it's terrifying. Thanks, Bruce, for the call. I shopped on Sunday morning, and of course, there are red lines where you know, you should stop and when you're in line, and that's great. But nobody makes eye contact. It's terrifying.
Yeah. It really is. And I hope things, when we beat this pandemic, and we will, that things will slowly come back to normalcy.
Yeah, man. All right. Back to the phones. Clifton Park. Jeff, you're on.
Hey, guys. How's it going? I'm a little concerned with myself. I'm not exactly sure how at risk I am, to be honest. I beat a form of leukemia 2 years ago. A couple of nurses that I've known have reached out to me asking if I'm okay or concerned, and they are unsure if I'm immunocompromised myself or not. My doctor's kind of even on the same boat. I had a form of leukemia a few years ago, but my boss is playing that fine line of we are exempt from the essential thing, and he just keeps trying to say, oh, well, we do this, and it changes every time they were changing, who is essential and not. And to face facts, what I do for a living, I know for a fact, is not essential. But yet I'm being asked to work, and I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to do. I am somebody who would like to be home. I am uncomfortable being elsewhere with all of this going on.
Yeah, sure. And first, I'm happy to hear that your leukemia, it sounds like you beat it the first time, and you're currently healthy. So I'm happy to hear that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. From my understanding, the Family First Act that the government passed has some guidelines about if you have underlying conditions, and not a doctor myself, a medical doctor, nor a lawyer. I would look at that to see if there's something in those guidelines. If you can get a notification from your physician that you are someone that is at an increased risk. I mean, it sounds like currently you're not under any kind of drug therapy. You probably have, I'd imagine they've done a blood count recently, so you might have a normal white blood cell count. So you might be quote unquote, not compromised, you're immunocompetent. But if there is a concern by you or your doctors, I think you can work with them to see if there's some kind of way you can apply for that Family First Act to get at least I believe it's 2 weeks of sick pay. I'm not sure what else is involved in there, but certainly I'd look into that and maybe there's something there.
Jeff, thank you and be safe, my friend. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And let's see, the lines are really loaded here, Eric. Let's grab at least one or two more before,
all right.
before the next too. Break. And okay, Ed in Latham. Ed, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, doctor. I have a question. I live with my parents. They're both in their 80s. And I need to go to the grocery store today to pick up one of their prescriptions and also to get some groceries. And I'm concerned as to what precautions I should take in doing so.
Yeah, well, I share your concerns, Ed. So even I have my mother and grandmother. I shop for them a couple weekends in a row. And it's kind of the same idea. You always feel nervous now about leaving the house. Particularly if your situation with parents that are older and kind of the prime, one of the at-risk groups. So I think it's, you know, you have to get food somehow and it's not easy to get it delivered. So to go out, what I would recommend is, again, practicing the social distancing as best you can in the grocery store. When you come back in, make sure that you wash your hands the proper way, you know, that with soap and water. You may want to, some people feel comfortable wiping down their food. If you feel like that's an extra precaution you want to take, I've seen people do that. So you can use soap and water on some of your food products that are able to be washed. And then, you know, that's the best you can really do. I think if you want to wear a mask, the mask really, as I mentioned, is more to protect people. If they think they're carrying it, it's not necessarily going to prevent something from being passed to you. But the primary thing is hand washing and social distancing at this point.
All right, Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Quickly over to Chris, driving to Schoharie. Chris, you'll be the last one before our next break. Go ahead.
Yeah, lots of news is out there about carriers that show no symptoms. So let's say we're at the plateau, and now we're heading down off the mountain, and everybody seems to be getting better, yet there are still carriers out there who can disease our old folks without their knowledge. So how, in actuality, can we determine a true plateau? Being that we don't know how many people are carrying it that can transfer the disease to others.
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris. That's where we are with mitigation, is that it's hard. We're at the stage now where we're just trying to reduce the number of cases to get to that plateau. And what's likely going to happen, and if you've seen in the news, China's in this boat right now, is switching from mitigation to containment. And it was sometimes shocking to see, I forget where they were walking, maybe it was a Great Wall of China, but there's just people packed together walking, you know, arm to arm almost on the Great Wall of China. And the worry there is that, just as you said, Chris, there could be people there that are asymptomatic passing it from person to person.
Yeah.
So really the only thing we can do is, I mean, testing. Oh, go ahead, sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, have we determined a length of time that you can carry this disease and still transfer it? Or is this something that once you have it, you can always transfer
it? Right. So this is definitely not a disease like chickenpox that if you are infected, you're infected for life and worry about re-exposure. This is a virus similar to other respiratory viruses that you contract it once, your body clears it, and you will develop immunity to it. That's a good question about how long is the duration of the disease. And the one issue we have right now is the testing that's done is through molecular testing. So we're looking for the presence of the virus's blueprint. And unfortunately, it doesn't tell us whether the virus is alive or it's dead. It just tells us that there's a piece of it there. So there's testing that's being developed that might allow us to better identify that, so we can be able to take a patient and say, you know, you're no longer transmitting the virus. And there is some differences in person to person. In most cases, it seems like after, you know, a period of 10 to 14 days when the person is symptom free, they seem to be fine and they're no longer able to pass the disease. And some people, it seems a little bit longer. So it's, what we really need is some tests that can tell us, is the virus being transmitted alive, first off. And then secondly, when we have serological tests, we can identify people that have been exposed and now have immunity against the virus.
And thank you for that call, Chris. But Eric, once we have this serology test, isn't there the possibility then we will realize, well, the infection rate is high, but the actual illness rate and death rate is much lower than we thought because more people had this thing?
Exactly. And that's the kind of information that epidemiologists and health officials need to plan proper control for if we do expect additional waves to come in the summer and fall. If we have those numbers, and some people, you might recall, we talked about herd immunity, I believe, a couple times.
Right.
So if we achieve that via natural infection or once a vaccine is made available, that makes it far less difficult for a virus like COVID-19 to establish an epidemic level. So we can keep it at bay, provided that people are surveying effectively and taking the vaccine. So once we have that, we can definitely be able to control it better.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Yeager, we'll grab some emails on the other side of the break, and then we'll hit the home stretch. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC Medical Monday. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. We talk coronavirus at 800-348-2551. And a few emails here, Eric. This one is from Phyllis, and it's a simple question. We've seen much information on this, and it changes seemingly day to day. Is it safe to take ibuprofen for pain unrelated to the coronavirus?
Yeah, so just like we talked about at the beginning of the show, it's some information comes out, it gets disseminated widely, and it gives everyone pause. So the idea that ibuprofen might be problematic stems from the idea that there was some theorized and some experimental information that taking ibuprofen might change the expression of the door that the virus needs to get inside our cells. So that would be problematic because, you don't want to make it more easy for the virus to cause disease. So the World Health Organization came out with a statement on it, and it was kind of a double negative statement, so it was very confusing. Unfortunately, they kind of corrected that. So right now, there is no evidence to suggest that ibuprofen worsens disease. It's something that's being looked at, but there is no evidence to suggest it worsens disease. The bigger case is probably to make sure you're not taking doses that are counterindicative to anything else you're taking or doses that are too high to cause like gastric distress and some other problems.
All right, a couple of questions here, and I'm going to lump JP's question and Lisa's question together. What are we learning about why the virus can kill some and not affect others, specifically with regard to age?
Sure. So it's like we talked about in the first came on the show, is, you know, worry about the elderly. They seem to be most at risk, and then they seem to be an increase in number of patients, even those that are hospitalized and in some cases intubate on ventilators that were our age group, you know, 30 to 50s. So what scientists really theorize now is we still are starting to see what is the cause of that. So it could be the person's genetics. It could be how their immune response is working with or against the virus. So in some cases, it's thought that perhaps the immune system is causing the damage to the lungs. We call that a cytokine storm, and that was seen during the 1918 pandemic flu. There could be some differences in how much virus they received. There could be some other genetic differences in the receptor that I talked about, that ACE2 receptor, that door to get inside cells. So there's a lot of, again, gaps in our knowledge as to why some people that don't appear to have underlying health conditions that are at an age that you would not suspect to have problems are showing severe disease. And that's something that unfortunately we won't know until we do more study. And probably after the outbreak is subsided, we'll have a lot of data to go through to figure out why these things are happening.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. One last email, and then we'll jump back to the phones. This one's from Patrick, and I got to say, this has crossed my mind at least once anyway. It's not always on my mind. And Patrick's question is related to the use of cash for payments of goods. Patrick writes, I'm hoping to open my seasonal business, albeit a bit later than normal this summer. Will the COVID-19 virus remain active in the cash exchange process, or is that another confusing aspect of the do's and don'ts?
So they've done some studies to look at the ability of viruses, influenza and coronaviruses on surfaces. So I think we talked about with coronaviruses, they found it could live on plastics and metals, certain metals for a period of a few days, on some other surfaces a little bit less. So there is a chance that the virus could live on currency, particularly if it's mixed in with body fluids like mucus, for example. It could live even longer. So I know I appreciate that in certain businesses, you can't deal with other situations outside of cash. So it's kind of his way he wants to do business. So I would probably recommend wearing gloves if possible to handle the cash. Make sure you wash your hands before and after transactions. So I would say playing it safe. There's always the possibility that it could be there, and just play it safe and follow the precautions.
All right, very good. Back to the phones we go with Dr. Eric Yeager, 1-800-348-2551. Roxanne is in Schenectady. You're on.
Oh, hello. Hi. I had to go to a doctor's appointment on Friday, and I was a bit surprised that the doctor and the nurse were wearing cloth masks. And while they did maintain, like, you know, a reasonable distance, I don't know that it was 6 feet. Excuse me, I'm just a little concerned, like, you know, like how risky that appointment may have been to me. And my second quick question is, I happen to have had like a few surgical masks, so I wore one along with gloves to the appointment. And my confusion is, like, the surgical mask doesn't protect the wearer at all from any exposure.
So hi, Roxanne. Thanks for your question. Let's go back a few months, like, you know, where life was a little different. So like last year, if you went in for a surgery or an appointment, even like a dental cleaning, there's, you know, the person you're dealing with is wearing gloves and a mask. And in most cases, the mask is to protect you as the patient in the chair or in the mm-hmm. examination room, in case that person has anything, they don't want to pass it to a patient. That's especially true for surgeries. It doesn't necessarily mean that person is sick with something. They just don't want to take the chance to pass it to you. So I believe what your doctor and his nurse was doing was just wearing this as a precaution, just in case they were carrying something, they weren't going to pass mm-hmm. it to you. So the cloth mask, I imagine it's difficult to find certain masks. So if perhaps it was all they were able to get. But the surgical mask is the next step up. And then really the mask that does protect someone from being exposed rather than preventing them from exposing someone else is that N95 mask we talked about. And those are in a little bit limited supply. And those are really predominantly for the first line responders and for the medical professionals. So I think they're wearing it just to protect you. It doesn't mean that they were sick. It just means they wanted to put your health at the forefront.
Roxanne, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences is our guest today. And Bill is in Glenville. Bill, you're up.
Hi. My wife takes methotrexate for rheumatoid arthritis, and I'm wondering if she's at a greater risk than the average person. Should she contact this virus?
I would probably contact the physician just to see if there's any other indication. Certain drugs can have some suppressive activities on the immune system, and it escapes me right now if methotrexate does. I apologize. But typically, if there's a drug a person is taking, for example, if there's certain patients that are transplant patients or under chemotherapy, there are certain drugs that do somewhat compromise your immune system, makes it a little bit weaker. So that person theoretically could be at an increased risk. But I would just double check with your pharmacist or your primary care physician to see if there's any concern there.
Bill, thank you for the call. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. We have been joined, luckily we've been joined several times over the past few weeks by Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy, and has helped sort of focus what we need to know about the coronavirus pandemic as it unfolds in front of us. And the information changes as we go along, but it's been really great to have him here. David in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Yes, Ray. Thanks for a great show.
Thank you.
The report on radio from the federal medical department said that the coronavirus is mutating in south of the equator into a different virus, and they're expecting a coronavirus 2 in the fall that will be different from the virus that's happening now. Do you have any information on that?
Thanks for your question, David. So this virus, like other viruses that have a similar blueprint, RNA, these viruses tend to mutate. And when you hear mutation, we immediately start to think, oh, it's going to become a worsened virus. The viruses tend not to like to mutate because it can compromise their ability to become infectious. So it can actually make for a weaker virus. With this virus, comparing the SARS-CoV-2 or the COVID-19 virus to other viruses like flu. So flu mutates, and that's why we have seasonal epidemics. The virus mutates and it actually beats our immune system. Our immune system no longer recognizes it. For the COVID-19 virus, it does mutate, but in a different way and at a different rate. So it seems like from the papers I've read that the mutation rate is far lower than influenza. So there's less of a concern that this virus will mutate into something that's even more transmissible or more pathogenic. And because we have these tools, the tools that didn't exist in the 1918 pandemic, we have now, we can easily take these viruses and look at their blueprints, see what the letters are, and if what the letter, we can track what letters are changing and if that indicates differences. And as I mentioned, it's not so much a difference in pathogenicity right now, but scientists have used those differences in letters to track where the viruses have spread from people to people in communities. So the mutations so far have been used more of a tracking mechanism rather than a concern of increased pathogenicity. But we're definitely, scientists are looking at this to make sure that they track these changes and see if anything does come up with how these maybe respond to different treatments. Because it could be that maybe the different strains might respond differently to different therapies. So it's something to keep an eye on, but I haven't heard as much traffic or noise about worry about a virus on the horizon that's going to become even worse than this one. I think right now we're worried about this virus and trying to make a vaccine against it to keep it lower, and then hopefully that'll get us through the rest of the year.
David, thank you very much for the call. We go to Diamond Point, New York. Nancy, what's on your mind?
Hello, and this is a great program. I have an epidemiological question. I wondered if the current screening tests, are they testing antigen or antibodies? And if you could say a little bit about the difference in those kind of tests and what's more accurate and at what particular stage of infection. And I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer on the radio.
Thanks, Nancy.
Okay. Thanks, Nancy, and thanks for the kind words. I'm happy to appear on with Ray. So the test that's being performed now is primarily a molecular test. So what the test is looking for is to take a swab. They go deep back in your nose. I hear it's very uncomfortable. That's where the virus is residing, though. They take that swab and they isolate what's called RNA, and that's the blueprints of the virus. And they perform a test called PCR, which amplifies one copy of the virus to millions of copies so that it's easier to identify and detect. So that's the primary test we're using. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, it tells us if the virus blueprint is present, but it tells you very little about the person's immune status or potentially when they were infected. So this test just tells us if someone comes in with symptoms, yes or no, it's a COVID-19 or potentially influenza. Now, the test that you mentioned, the serological test, that would be the antibody test. And it typically takes for an immune response to work, usually around 10 to 14 days for our bodies to develop antibodies against a virus. So the serological test would be more useful for someone that has cleared the infection or someone that maybe was exposed months ago that never showed symptoms. We can track to say, has this person been exposed? As Ray mentioned, then we can modify our numbers in terms of what is the overall infection rate, what is the mortality rate. So right now, what the testing is primarily done is when patients come in, do they have COVID-19, treat them as such. And then going forward, we need to get the data for the serum, both to track people that have recovered, but also importantly, there's a lot of good therapies coming up that are dealing with convalescent serum. So we can identify people that have cleared the virus and developed antibodies against it. There's a number of studies happening at Mount Sinai, at the Mayo Clinic and University of Washington, where they're collecting antibodies from patients that have cleared the infection and giving them to other patients to see if that impacts their disease positively, or perhaps to give it to first-line responders working in hospitals to protect them transiently until a vaccine is developed.
Let's jump over to Troy, New York. And Tom, you're on.
Yeah, I just recently had heard that there's some people saying that certain blood types are not as susceptible. Is there any truth to that?
That's information that has been out there as well, Eric.
Yeah, so that's kind of as we talked about, information comes out and then it kind of travels very quickly through the media sources. And there was some initial suggestion that in a number of cases, a certain percentage of individuals in China, when they were infected, they had a blood type of A. So there were some pause to say, well, should we track this to see if there is some link between blood type and the person being sick? And this is what happens with every type of infection or disease. They're looking for correlates because it helps the clinician make a better diagnosis. So they're looking to see diabetes, hypertension, COPD as underlying factors that can make a disease more severe. So blood type is something that they looked at, but I haven't seen anything more recent from that initial study that had this anecdotal evidence that perhaps blood type played a role. I don't think it plays what we're seeing here in the cases in New York and in the country. I haven't seen anything to link blood type to the disease severity.
Thanks, Tom, for the call. How many people do you need to make a valid study? In other words, this hydroxychloroquine study, the initial one out of France, I think the guy had 40 patients. Is that enough?
It was a very small number, and two things have to come into play. So first, having a number of patients, and then second, you want to have the proper controls. So some of these studies that have come out using hydroxychloroquine, the controls were either lacking or just a little bit messy. So it made the data a little bit harder to validate as being strong enough to say, yes, definitely, let's go forward with this. So you need a number of patients. They need to try to, as best you can, link to having, of course, the same disease, the age group, their gender, their ethnicity, potentially their underlying health conditions. So the more patients you can gather to do the study, the better. And then you need to split them up into a group that gets the drug and doesn't get the drug. So it can be challenging to do. That's why there's at least 5 or maybe a dozen studies looking right now, and they're looking to collect a lot more people. So the more people we have, the better the data, the stronger the data is that we can say yes or no, this is the drug we should follow.
All right, let's go for one more call here. It's got to be a quick one. Sonia in Albany, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I am calling because my question is, one of our friends called us last Saturday and said that she wasn't feeling well. My immediate reaction was to, she has a 2-year-old son, and we immediately removed the son from the house. It has been 10 days now, and she has been showing and had showed many signs of the virus. She has gone to the hospital locally, being sent in the ER. They have not been able to do a test because of the severity of others needing. Her symptoms were not that strong. She has gone to her doctor's office, and they've also basically told her to go home and quarantine herself. But definitely, if she has severe breathing issues, to return back to the ER.
We only have about 30 seconds
here. Okay, my question is here on the fact that we still have her 2-year-old son, and we're in day 10. The only thing that has not returned back to her is her smell. We're looking for a time frame, not knowing when to help her with her child.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear about your friend, Sonia, and it's nice of you to take care of her child. So I believe on the CDC website, they have different criteria. So the test is one if you have 2 negative tests between a 24-hour period. But I believe it's also if the fever breaks or symptoms resolve within 7 days, that person is considered clear.
Okay.
But I would just double check the CDC website because there is a nice chart that says what is the criteria for a person that's resolved the infection.
Hey, Eric Yeager, I ask you this every show, and quickly.
Sure.
Are you nervous? Are you worried?
I'm optimistic. I think I'd rather say, you know, it is. I do feel for all my students that I'm dealing with, and it's affecting them and their home life. But I'm optimistic. I mean, we have people that we have information. We have scientists. People are following by and large. So I have optimism in people following through. I have optimism in humans. I have optimism in science. So concerned, yes, but more optimistic.
Well, man, thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. Support comes from Gomez Neurology, Albany, a neurology clinic at Infusion Center, providing care for neuromuscular disorders and headaches, multiple sclerosis, and chronic pain. Patients see a physician at every visit, GomezNeurology.com. Thanks again to Dr. Yeager for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach, the engineer, Jackie, our producer. See you tomorrow.